Peter Hill Explains, where I invite you to join the science teaching conversation with me about
Tales of Rocket Man. I'm going to give a little bit of a background of what it's actually like to be walking about with a rocket part inside yourself. In fact, I think you would call it a rocket part or a cruise missile part, to be a bit more accurate about. And that's a beautiful positive story, but more to prosaic stuff at the moment. To my surprise, I had a friend actually listen to a podcast and come back and said, "Oh, look, the sound drifted off," and I've slowly added bits and pieces to the podcast process. The batteries were failing last time, and I've got a shotgun microphone, which is excellent because it just picks up my voice and tends to edit out other sounds coming around the place, so it produces a good quality sound some of the time. But it means that when I drift off, I get a bit thing up, put the shotgun away from me, and the sound disappears, and I can imagine people straining to see it. Now, the aim of these podcasts, unfortunately, fortunately for me, is to get practice speaking and putting, you know, I'm going to think about an idea and present an idea, and it's a long process, so it may seem good at this stage, but it's just, you know, building one tiny veneer of skill on top of another skill going forward. So it's the cognitive process of saying, I'm going to talk about this, structuring thoughts, and getting it through. So we are living in a funny age. I think in the Marvel comics, they've got Captain America and a piece of shrapnel's in his heart, and they actually, he puts something, a device in his heart, and it moves 1 inch one way or 1 inch the other way, he'll die. And so there's that tension associated with it, and there's this marvellous super thing coming from a heart. I don't have any power or anything like that, but I do sort of feel like sort of a Captain Australia or Captain New South Wales. And to get the effect, you have to actually be pushed right down and be incapacitated and then have this part put in you, and you're alive again. And so there is that aspect of Captain America, and I want to sort of go through some of the lows and the highs and the structures and the sort of the weirdness which goes with the overall process. So, yes, I am a super sick man. I am normal and advanced, and so that's an absolute sort of credit to the medical community that things have come along. Of course, there's a lot of rehab to get yourself back and going. And it's one of the stranger things was teaching the students at school open heart surgery. We would do a series of projects on the heart. One would be to dissect various bits of heart, and you'd see the heart strings, a bit of the valves, and the process of the valves of something pumping. And it was rather interesting because when I went in, I began to look at the diagrams in there, and the heart was in the wrong position. You go in the heart surgery in the wrong position, and the names were wrong, and indeed this, we'll go into that in a little bit. So at school, we get the heart, open it up and cut it out. What would happen is that they always do a nice chop and chop off the aorta and the pumping stations for it and stuff like that. We'll get people to make up paper hearts. I don't know, there are all these various things, but we'd also go online and do online heart surgery. And what would happen is that you go into the rib cage and you get some tears and crack open the rib. It would be a very gory thing, and people's mouse control wouldn't be quite right. They'd strike the wrong way, and then blood would come down the screen, and you'd see these lawyers come in. Unfortunately, this is true for almost all education. It was completely fluffy. You know, like you'd find something good, then you'd find something wrong with it. And then you'd, like, 90% of what I taught eventually when I studied it strong enough, like it wasn't my field, in my direct field it was obviously wrong. In other fields it's other wrong. So this is one of the amazing things that you'd be teaching, and a majority of the stuff would be wrong. But let's get back into hearts and processes. So the heart doesn't pump the body. The heart pumps into a pressure release vessel, which stores high pressure blood. So the heart is a pump, and a pump primes a compression vessel. This might be news to people, but it's like pneumatic tools or anything like that. You have the big sort of pressure bottle there, so there's a pressure bottle there, and now the heart's purely to get the fluid passing through the components with the oxygenated, you know, the power blood, empowered oxygen powered blood, go through. And let's go through there. Now, one of the interesting things is that the heart, there are a few obvious things which are powered by blood pressure and stuff like that, but put that aside. One of the more interesting things is that your cute little spiders which come around the place are hydraulically powered. So everything else has muscles, but spiders are powered by hydraulics. That is, they have pressure, and they move about the place, and they can move very fast. And this is one of the part of the fascination things. And this is just going off to an aside. You know, spiders absolutely fascinate me. They're my friends. Sometimes they're too big, and sometimes they're, I don't know, things like that. And I was told to get all the spider webs off around the outside of my house. And of course, as I look around, I say, oh my God, I haven't done that particular job too well. But my good friend, 90-year-old friend, which I look after a little bit, said, I like spiders around my house too. It gets rid of the mosquitoes. And so people are friends with spiders, and spiders are hydraulically powered. But your heart system is a hydraulic system. The blood actually doesn't do anything, but it actually just provides energy environment for the other muscles and stuff like that. And the major thing is that the heart pumps this central pressure vessel, which is the aorta. It's a sort of like a candy cane, a big tube inside you. And just as a side story, years before, I encountered aortas in this Chinese banquet. Wasn't the head of the Chinese Communist Party. It was sort of like two or three rungs down from the brother of the who was in Tianjin University, and then I was guest of honour. In fact, I'm sure they had a banquet every 2 weeks, and the foreigners that were in there happened to be the best. The guest of honour. I was actually constructing a laser lab for them, poor people over there. This is 1991, but we had this banquet, and it's hard to describe it because there was different types of food for different people. I had Chinese food, but the people in the Communist Party, up in the top of the Communist Party, had highly chili food, because, and look, this is one of these facts that you can take as either. There's a whole lot of facts that you hear which are false, and you hear and you find out that they're true, and there's facts that you actually experience yourself. So this is a direct experience fact. So people can contradict me, and I'll step back and say, well, I really don't care. This is what I experience. Yeah, so they it just struck me that it could have been something else, but yeah, they had high chili food because in the Communist Party back then, or in that particular group, or I don't know whether it's absolutely true, but because Chairman Mao went to Shishen or something like that, where they have very hot food. He made a statement about real men can eat hot food, and therefore committed all everyone in the Communist Party in that time to eating hot food. Realised that they couldn't possibly do this to a foreigner, and so they gave me the food, but I had to eat different things. And I don't know whether I've been pranked, but I had to, one part, I had to eat a cow's aorta, and I had heard the way aorta, and it is tougher than a garden hose, completely inedible, and it's just large enough so that you couldn't swallow it. And so I'd eventually chewed through it, but it was just extremely hard. So this aorta is basically a muscle, a tube muscle in your in the center of your body. It goes down and goes into two halves, and it's actually interesting that there's different connections to your umbilical cord. Those bottom halves are your leg arteries, and basically arteries are in actual fact a hollow muscle, and they're very sensitive, and essentially they squeeze like toothpaste the blood through the body. So you go bump bump, so the bump bump is the two valves clicking, and that second bump is the blood pushing into the aorta and shutting the door shut. So it pumps the blood into the aorta, shuts the door, and then the aorta goes, is being forced out a bit, slowly compresses and pushes the blood through these tiny capillaries. Now, capillaries are high resistance tubes, so it requires, it's sort of like going down, it's like caking mix. You're piping, you cake, you have to push it down these fine tubes. And in fact, every cell in the body is within no distance at all from one of these fine, tiny little tubes. So eventually it sort of goes down and comes up through your veins. Now, your veins, in actual fact, are a de facto valve, because inside your vein is one complete sort of continuous valve section. So blood can only flow one direction down a valve. Sorry, down a vein. And it can actually flow one direction back up into the blood. And if it flows the other direction, the vein swells up and holds the blood. This is sort of an interesting aspect, because counting the valves in the circulation system, there's technically six valves, four in the heart and two in the veins, the body veins and the veins between the lung, the pneumatic vein and stuff. We can go into it. It's a little bit conceptually hard. So conceptually hard that the diagrams of it, this is going into obviously it's got your attention. You're going to heart surgery and it's heart. You do pay attention, and then when the people, so the intermediately, the surgeons obviously know what they're doing, but intermediately people have sort of gone by talks, and the talks have become wrong over the time. And they're only wrong when you actually say, oh, well, how does that actually work? And we'll get into me, the working, the crisis and the resolution and the happy story and the punching the air and the idea of putting a rocket part in me. I'll eventually get into that. But people will have the heart in the wrong position, and then the heart orientation. So the left hand of the heart, in real points, the heart points out to your left elbow, roughly speaking, from the centre of your chest down to your left elbow. And what we call the left half of the heart is actually rotated around to the back half of the heart. So technically, this is all true. Indeed, the heart has not four chambers but six. It's actually got these, this is all true, these little dog ears on them. They're called oracles, after ear. The ancients used to thought they'd get a heart. Now, there you get a heart, it's nicely packaged. But this is another thing you have to learn, that every organ is sort of like, it's got a membrane around every organ. And so it's a bit like, you go shopping for the parts of the body in the food section of Coles or Woolworths. You put it together and you leave it in its packaging and you put it in there. So the heart, it's got its cling wrap, it's got a membrane on the outside of it. So the heart's got this. Now, you take off the membrane and these ears, I'm not joking, these ears flop out. These are the oracles. And you only pick this up when you are actually doing computer graphics to explain to the kids, your school kids, which, you know, I didn't get to show very much, what operation you had. And so you've got these things called oracles coming out. And so and then inside there's a set of valves, and the pump, the valve closes, the boom, and then dump. Next dump is the valve closing the next time. So the dump dump is like door shutting, sort of like angry teenagers running out of the house, saying they're running out of the bedroom, running out of the front. They're really pissed off with something you've said. You clean up your room. Well, I'm not going to clean up, Mum. Slam the door. Slam, slam, as they run out. And then they run around, go into their window again, and slam, slam. And so you get that dum-dum. There is a reason I'm actually going into this dum-dum. So you've got this aorta. Now, the valve between your heart and your aorta is a pretty critical one. Under high pressure, and evolution has done a great job. They've had a design with three balloons, which, when the heart pumps out, when the aorta tries to actually push the blood back into the heart, it fills up these three party balloons, and the three party balloons expand, and they actually stop it. It was, we're going to have to pump the blood around the rest of the body. I'd much prefer easier to pump it back to the heart. So I was a Charles Darwin would say, quite simple, or due to evolutionary end of the road for you, because you've got something which is less survivable. Rather than having four, I've got two. And so if you can imagine the blowing a raspberry like that. Okay, right. So blowing a raspberry with water. Say if you had a sip of champagne and you someone laugh and you got in your lips and the lips, and it will just jet through your lips. That's what was happening. My heart was having a murmur, and it was, you know, looking back, it was picked up. It was picked up by the army. They said, "Oh, you're hearing a bit of a murmur here. Oh, you'll do." I don't know what they were thinking again. And so at various points, and I didn't know the significance of a murmur, but the murmur means that your valve closes, it goes, pump, and then it goes, actually, some of the blood is pushing back, and that's actually quite a serious thing. So, as the valve got more, it had to get more and more strong to actually close, like it was dud. And so as it got dud, it got smaller and harder and more cardboardy and cardboardy, so rather than soft, you have a soft carrot sitting in your drain, stopping the water going down. But if you get these sort of hard, cornflakes, or hard almonds, there it doesn't seal as much. And so it was beginning to go downhill. Now, I sort of took a slightly different direction. I began my heart began to fail, and I got really fat. I couldn't get my shirt on because my arms wouldn't fit through the sleeves. My legs were rubbing together. Like, I wasn't, you know, people kept saying, "Oh, you're looking fine." I grew a beard because I began to get a double chin. Oh, my double chin's gone now. I grew a beard, a double chin, and bags under the eyes. And as you began to fill up with fluid, your heart's not closing. And then you'd go to the doctor and you say, "Oh, look, I just can't. I'm going up a hill. I'm losing my breath going up a hill." "Oh, you're not taking the right supplements, iron supplements, or what, magnesium supplements, which I happen to be selling. All this type of stuff." So it'd be very tough, and you're realising that, "Oh, she is." And you don't realise that you're doing these various things. These are the years leading up to it. Now, also going in, my grandfather and father died essentially of this. It was only when I went through it that I decoded all the clues. "You will understand this at a certain time, my child, going forward." You'd say, in a head, "Oh, set of stairs, I'm going to be out of breath before it gets. I'll start breathing now." And I would ahead of breathe for various going up steps of sets of stairs. And then dangerous situations, I could actually, I wouldn't fight or get angry at anybody because it would just be really bad for me to get angry or really bad. I don't know. And so there's various times where they said, "Oh, you can't go up here without a heart condition." I didn't know I had a heart condition. I said, "But okay, I'm going to have to." So this is in schools, you had to go right up this high thing. Oh, you know what it was? That you get up, they put in a harness, they lift you up the harness. I don't know quite how it is. You pull a support thing for the harness, it releases you and you swing back and forth. And of course this is terrifying, so what you do is mentally you can eventually you have to do it. You can actually, I put myself into a physical trance, and so all the students were oh my god, because I was just like a lifeless corpse going in. And then I woke up afterwards because I actually physically because of it, and sort of with the valve going. I hope this is helpful. You just go, "Oh, I'm going to sneeze, and you think, "Oh," you wouldn't think. It's hard to say. I didn't think, "Oh, I'm going to die." I think you'd be very frightened sneezing, not for no connected reason, and it would be. You'd sneeze and you'd run outside and you wouldn't you wouldn't go like that. You would just blow it out, open your mouth as much so there'd be no pressure whatsoever. It was a horrible thing. And of course, after the operation, after they've got it and I sneezed, I didn't feel it. I just punched the air, sort of like, "Throw pepper at me, this is fantastic." Okay, so there's this process. Now, there's the people around you who say, "Look, you haven't got a heart condition," going with you to the doctors, "He hasn't got a heart condition." And then eventually they say, "Oh, yes, they do." And eventually, once in a while, there was sort of arguments going on. "He doesn't," to these junior cardio. And then this person got confused, went out, saw a senior cardio person, came in and said, within seconds, "This is what it is, you're having an operation, blah, blah, blah." And so I was going to have this operation. So let's describe the operation a little bit. So going in, you have these charts, these things. Now we have these things, everyone's going for this, but I'd like you to look at this option. So there was basically a cow valve, which is sort of like a reconstruction, a tribute to what your valve used to be like. So it's using, they don't take the valve of the cow. There's the material which wraps the heart, that material. So this wrapping materials is really interesting. So let's talk about inside you. There's this cling wrap inside you. Quite seriously, cling wrap inside you. It's called your pericardial, whatever it is. But they can actually put it through, put a valve in it, and blow up as a balloon. And so if they want to do keyhole surgery in you, they get in the keyhole, seal the keyholes. But in order to get, there's no point, you can imagine trying to do keyhole surgery in a casserole. So what they do is they pump you with carbon dioxide and you inflate up as a balloon. And I know all these types of stuff because I use this for teaching kids about balloons, or like air pressure. Yeah, it really gets them there. Oh, I can do it. And there's a James Bond movie where someone fires an air pressure, and of course these amazing, not 12 year olds, something like this, all have seen James Bond and violent movies and stuff like that. All an amazing thing. And this inside layer this of cows is called, not cows, this is between your muscular outer, your outer muscles and your internal organs. It's a thin, very thin membrane, and this is gold beater's membrane, because what you do is you get your piece of gold in between this membrane and then you can just hammer it out and then you peel it off and you've got this very thin gold foil. It's also used for the inside of the Hindenburg, because it's very ultra thin impermeable. So the original large balloons used to be, the Hindenburg was herds and herds of cattle, and in England there was people sort of were pushed out of the mills and used to stitch up the inside of these cows going inside. But sort of slightly thinner, the thicker of this fantastic flexible super membrane, which lasts a long time, flights of the Hindenburg, is sewn up in factories in Singapore. And they sew up heart valves. And you can have that. And going through, and you read down your spec sheets, and it says 17 years, asterisk, less, with these factors, younger, less, people being mean to you. Oh, far out, shit. Oh, because this is one of the problems is that, say, if you've got the heart condition, you never respond to people, because you can't. Like, I know that. Thank goodness I've had it. And so you say, oh, this is bad. And so it's got this performance ratio, but it drops down after 12, 18 months. It's back down to... And they have to open you up again in 13 years. But you've got 13 years of fantastic life. Dancing, going down the Rhine, and sort of... I thought, well, no, that's not me. That's, you know, I'm in a situation where people aren't nice to me. I'm not going to have a fantastic life. Well, this is over here. Well, this one here, this mechanical one. Let me see. It's got a lifetime of 10 research paper. I'll look up the research paper later. I'll research paper. Patient lifetime of 10 to the 7 years. Oh, 10, not 17 years. 10 to the 7, that's 10 million years. What's going on here? Oh, well, because it's a aerospace part, we can put it in an aerospace engine and test it. And then, because it's a registered mechanical part, we can do performance measurements on it and actually see what's going on. And so there goes the story. So I'll go back into this story. So this little part is actually a rocket part. It's actually directly from the front of a V1 German Vengeance weapon. It's that it's got this panel, it's got these flaps which close, so when the blood goes the opposite side, it hits these mechanical flats. And these flats, it's made out of pure carbon under a process more like sort of plasticky diamond on the outside. So this is the plasticky diamond, gives it its 10 million year lifespan. And so when I go, when other people go thump, thump, I go thump, ding, sort of like a fairy bell goes inside. In fact, it is a little clatter. And I'll just go into the operation. So go in, and you're going, it's hard to say, look, I think as a quantum physicist, this is Schrodinger's cat, alive and dead. It was, in terms of different percentages, I didn't say, look, I'm laying my chips on this, and this is the way it goes. My wave function hadn't collapsed yet. I was both alive and dead going into it. So it was, very much, what would I like for my last meal, which happens to be ravioli. This is one of the strange things. You have your last meal, and you have to make a call about what meal do you want to have? Do you really enjoy? And I don't know if you can remember visiting me at Gunther's place, where I had a can of ravioli. So that's what I think. Ravioli is my signature dish. Okay, but going in. You go in, there's a whole series of processes at the showroom of which one you want to get, and then which ones you're getting. And the actual technical people, everyone doing it, is saying, oh good, you've selected the right one. We're not allowed to tell you which one to select, but you selected the right one. This is the 10 million years versus 17 years dead performance. Now there's a catch with the mechanical one. And so you go in, and they have to shave you, completely shave you. Now, particularly if you're a bit fat, and I'm no longer fat, thank goodness, but and you have a lot of hair. Well, you probably wouldn't have that lot of hair, but I had a lot of hair. Enough, I thought, that you could be collected to make a cute teddy bear. You know, it's the stuffing of a teddy bear. What's that? Oh, that's my body here for operation. But they do actually give you a teddy, which I became rather attached to. Okay, and so they shave you up, and they give you these solutions. And it says, if you do have your glasses on, avoid putting it in your eyes. If you don't have it on, you do put it in your eyes, and you realize that, what did they actually say? And it says, do not put it in your eyes. But you have to disinfect your entire body twice. And then it goes on, and then they wheel you off. Now, one of the things that you've got to realize is that they don't, in surgery and going around a hospital, they don't have five patients. Because I was pretty excited in terms of, I was really going to enjoy the last, wheelchair ride, last whatever it is, I always wanted to high five, but they, for hygiene reasons, we understand now that they don't high five. I didn't quite understand that. And then I suppose one of the things I was fascinated in is because I worked in clean rooms, how they actually achieve some of the clean room aspects, which are probably a little bit better than the clean rooms that we worked at. This is high-tech clean rooms. Going in, and they said, they'll put you out. And I think one of the last things I heard going under was, oh, this heart-lung machine's on the blink. I feel out. And going across. So the surgery happens. Now, what happens is they do a cut from the sort of neck of your collarbones, that little U-shaped feeling at the top, your collarbones go up, down, and the sternum and cut right down. And if you're sick, if you don't like blood, it's not that bloody, it's only a verbal description. They cut down, and this person cut down with just a little bit of a curve, obviously you would note afterwards. And then they've got three slots, three drains into you, put the drain. And then they get a jigsaw, a stainless steel, high quality jigsaw, and cut your sternum in half. Now, of course, I didn't ask about this because I had taught it, and I had taught something completely different, is that they get a pair of pruning shears and smash your ribs apart. Because they don't do this, it's a fine thing. And then they get some octopus straps and pull your chest apart. They dig around and stuff like that. And I at this stage, was the heart. Well, so what had happened is I had gone through a slightly different trajectory for a lot of heart patients. I had gone a lot more advanced and kept a lot fitter by desperately exercising. But if I can say that I could walk down the block and lose my breath, and the pain was horrible, but I'd walk up at night when it was cool and walk up these gradients and have chest pains coming back, and just so I was just really pushing outside the envelope. So I was actually quite fit, fat, blubbery fit. My heart was very, very strong. However, it was packing up, and so there was one, I had one key artery which had closed up, so they did a reboot of that one, which they took an artery from my, they're going to do a shortcut, they can do a shortcut, but then they said, oh look, just for safety, such a good heart, we'll do it properly, and they took a vein from my leg, which, when I woke up, it was saying, oh shit, I hope I wasn't crucified, because I had this rot feeling at my leg, and it still occasionally feels a bit, feel a bit Christ-like, and something's gone on down there. No stigmata or anything like that. And so many hours in, so they don't rush, so it's all rushed. I don't know what the banter is. It's a bit, I've been in assisting in surgeries occasionally, there's a bit of a banter going on about, hey, what's going on here? Particularly, there's one where they, it's pretty interesting in terms of if they go around an old scar. So, if they've got to reoperate, they do a cut and sort of do a tummy tuck or a chest tuck around the old scar and lift that scar up and. Oh, well, yeah, it looked a bit nonchalant in terms of putting it into the nurse knows what's coming, they hold the little tray out and they put the little old scar in. Now, there is it's going to be an old scar story, and this will finish pretty soon. So, they cut open, jigsaw open, get in, then they have to take the packing. Well, they have to take the packing. Packaging of the heart, so they don't tell you this, don't work that out afterwards. And then the actual veins on the heart, the arteries on the heart, are held in and pressured in with fat. And so the entire process is incredibly important. And then, to get the valve out, they cut the aorta open. And they go in, and then they cut the aorta. And which way, there was this gasp, and they said, it's rotten. So thank goodness they picked it up. They had enough data. It was rotten. And indeed, they didn't keep it. And then they replaced it with this little, it's 20 cent, little valve stuff. I'll go into it later, then sew me up, going up. And what they don't tell you is that you can't move. You can't sit up. They have to help you sit up. And your heart is the heart-lung machine, which is going. Oh yeah, the heart-lung machine fills you up with fluid, and it's so hard to breathe out. So you your heart operation. You know, you had a reasonable lung capacity of 30%. At 10%, and now I'm up to 100%. So there you go. Afterwards, and it's absolutely fantastic. Afterwards, not immediately afterwards, but a while afterwards, when you get the fluid off the lungs. So they come in and photograph you, x-ray you in your bed. How do they do it? Well, they have a wireless x-ray exposure thing, plate they put in behind you. They come up, photograph you, and it appears on their mobile phone. Oh, yeah. this is crazy stuff. I suppose the hint I can have, it's the first hot shower you can have, you can actually get the complete congestion in your around. It's that first hot shower is the major thing. Obviously, you're sitting there, and there's no modesty. Well, yeah, not left anymore to go in. Now, the critical point that I really want to get in is that out of your chest, the little thing is two wires. And this is an important thing. There's two wires, a yellow and a red one. Important. How do I know about it? They said, firstly, it's time to take the tubes out now. There's the three tubes, drainage tubes, and they're x-raying you and the tubes out. Firstly, you get the ventilator out, and so when you're coming to, and it doesn't feel okay, the ventilator's out okay. And then they take the tubes out. Now, the tubes, I can tell you from the third time that you start to get this huge back pain and go, oh, I've got a back pain, oh, I think I might need some medication for it. And they said, great. And then they've got to tell, and then they take the tubes out, and then that's okay, the drainage tubes out. I think I had the drainage tubes for a fair while, first operation. They kept it in, but then they have these two little wires. Of course, the wires are in there to jumpstart your heart. They sew you up, get everything up, get it working again, let's do it, and they put a minuscule voltage across to jump your heart. And so it's the time to take the wires out. And of course, the person taking the wires out didn't ground themselves. And can you imagine with it was just the most distressing thing I could possibly imagine. And so obviously there's a story of the second reoperation going on. It's pointless being brave for it because you're in your own cocoon and there's nothing to help you. You may as well ask. I'm really concerned about taking out the wires. Don't worry, we'll put you on thousands of drugs and we'll knock you out. I didn't actually say, the actual problem is the person didn't ground them when they touched the wires and it just... But it is like this, and sort of the second time they took it out, there was nothing. I was going, oh. And of course, most of the time you don't look. You know, I just don't look when I'm getting injections or anything. I just don't look. Take it away. After a while, I say, "You know what you're doing. Excellent." And what else can I say? Oh, they have to ECG you. All the time. This is put these stickers on, and there's a person who put the ECGs on you, and I used to say compliments to various people, and I'd say that was fantastic, and I said to the next person through, oh, so and so was really good. They put the ECGs on. It was like this fluid thing. They put that little. Because it was great. And of course, that was the wrong thing to say to them because she suddenly began to think about it and completely mucked it up. And of course, I had various nurses coming in just to sit with me because they thought it was not amusing or fun or special or something like that. And then, of course, some of the students that I was teaching's mums were the teachers there. I said, look, I just can't have a teacher's interview, a teacher.
a parent-teacher interview staff. So that was a bit interesting to come in through here. So you have your valve. I want to talk a little bit about the valve in a short while. Then coming home, and you can't reach your feet. And so for getting socks on for 20 minutes, to really get your socks on, you've got nothing else to do. And of course your blood circulation is coming back, so you're absolutely freezing at home, putting the socks on. Put the socks on for 20 minutes, and then someone comes in and says, no, wife, name for wife, insert there. He's got the wrong socks on. He's what? And I was going, no! Help me. And then I had to go out for another 20 minutes unassisted with the person not helping me at all, but only commenting that I've got the wrong socks, get the right pair of socks in. And all I was doing was going down to up the street to get an x-ray. I was putting my shoes on. I was just appalling. So you eventually get to go. And the first time is just walking around the house. Eventually I kept on walking around the house, and from military training you just knew it's this train. I think this is General Moore's head in the fighting Rommel. He was the Australian general versus Rommel, and the Australians actually did stop Rommel with this Moore's head person, and he said he had a basic theory for the Australians, and that was train, and it would be sort of like you could make fun of them nowadays, but that was the basic thing. And so I eventually went round the house 50 times, and eventually the grass away. And I think back now is there's a slight gradient. There's a flat block, slight gradient. It's a big task getting around there, and then eventually out walking. And I walk up to stop. I can't go any further, and then go back to Google Earth, do a route, and then you get the gradient there and see what you can do. And then we go and walk several times a day, and eventually walk out, and eventually walk out this 13-kilometer loop back. It would take hours, and I can imagine this thing where I could only just put a foot in front of each other at a time. And what I thought was, that's great, there are so many police around. It's always police. That's great. Of course, it was only afterwards I realised that the police were checking on me. They were checking on me to go out. But the end result was that when they checked again, the valve was leaking around the outside. It had actually ripped out, and there was blood coming. It wasn't working well, and I was still saying, oh, look, I'm still short of breath, and he's short of breath. I take him for a walk, and he's short of breath. And all this policy, and this was going back to school, and this, oh, I'm the new principal, I'm going to really push and bully and stop acting as though you've got a heart condition, so you've had your heart operation, because I had to go back and have a second operation and stitched in, because the heart had become so weak, and whatever it is around the valve, putting the new valve, it unseated, it was slightly too large, and they shimmied it in. And so it's fantastic. So let's talk about why it's a rocket valve. So you've got to make something which lasts for a very long time. It's sort of the customer is not going to accept a failure. And so this is a shutter valve. It's a non-return valve, so it lets the blood out, and when the blood tries to get in, it slams shut. Now, I was absolutely amazed. We had a fat extractor from the above the oven, and it had seized up and clogged, partly because there's a possum had come in and lived in it, a few other things, but we took it out. And then sitting on top of the fat extractor, the range hood, it's called, was a valve. And it was a giant version, like, of the valve they put in exactly the same way, and it's actually seized up with fat. But it was this flap wheel. That's why I took that into school to show people, you know, this is what it is, but, you know, didn't necessarily go in. But it was designed for the flap of a V1. Then the Germans came up with the idea of using carbon to do various bad things. So on the base of the V2, they had these carbon fins, which rather than move the engine around, would flute the gas in one direction sufficiently quickly to keep the rocket from just going in an arc. It would keep it going on course to London or wherever it was going to go. And so they got the flap. And then the Germans began to make their jet planes using, again, carbon. So while the Americans were fiddling around with metal, and the British with metal, the Germans were just making their jet engine parts out of oak, and the oak would heat up and carbonise, and the carbon would be high temperature. So this is sort of like your ME, whatever it is, whatever they are, those jet planes. And so taking it on, the Americans then had the problem of making the nose cones for their nuclear re-entry missiles to come in. And so the parts are, the part itself is from a V1. The technology is started off with the V2, and with the American missiles, re-entry cones, they had to be really light, of the right properties, dark, black. And so they came up with this way of making a carbon build-up with the ideal, as you get the carbon build-up out of an oven, they actually got essentially a barbecue, propane barbecue gas, and oxygen, 10% oxygen, and heated it. And this would create a soot pattern, but the soot would grow into these flakes of graphite, and the graphite would land as snow, and would land on that, and the graphite would pull into each other into the super hard component, and this graphite snow would form as glassy, sort of crystallite, isotropic pyrolytic carbon, IPC. Isotropic because it's crystalline, but there's no crystal direction. It's this beautiful crystal type glass, which they get a pencil lead, a big pencil, graphite pencil lead, and they carve out the valve in it. And that's amazing. And you think, oh, that's a bit strange, but there's this entire thing of these artworks of people getting pins in their pencils and doing these exquisite pieces of artwork, microscopic artwork in the carbon. Do it there. And then they heat it with this, they coat it with this pyrolytic carbon, and then they test it, and in the end you get a 10 million year survival component. Now they're not making a nuclear power station or something big, they're just one component has this fantastic stuff. Definitely go for it. And interestingly, I took the sound profile of it when I first heard it. Or when I first got home, I would hear this at home at night. I'd hear this dripping sound. I can't hear it now. My brain has zipped it out. I have not heard it for a while. And I walk around into the different parts of the house looking for this dripping sound, and I stuck my head into a cupboard listening to it, saying there's no pipes there, but there's a dripping, you know, clink there. Walk out and saying, and you think, oh, I found out where the dripping is, and then you go somewhere else. And you look over and you listen, stick your head into it, and of course, eventually, obviously, it was this little ping, ping, ping. This pyrolytic carbon was nuclear missiles. Obviously, they've asked an engineer, and they said, use that. But then it also got use in the balls of a nuclear reactor. What people tend to love is fuel rods. Now, there's control rods, which is the stuff which kills a nuclear reactor. So a nuclear reactor, if you take out the brakes, it just goes gangbusters. It's always got a brake on it. The control rods, but the actual fuel rods, you can have fuel pellets or fuel balls. The great thing with fuel balls is that you can just, like a marble run, you can marble these marbles. You want your fuel ball to last a very long time, and so you cover it with this pyrolytic carbon. So from the head of a nuclear missile into the heart of a nuclear reactor is this material. It's got one other major use, is that it is phenomenally temperature conductive. So I've got the graphite, so it's basically pencil lead covered with this stuff, but it's phenomenally heat conductive, and in such a way that it actually is better than gold. The great thing is that so they put it in the back of iPhones and things like that, where you want to get the heat out, so that your component touches one of these things and its heat is distributed out to the edges. So the heat transfer is different along through the material than along the material. So it tends to really rocket up to the edge. Now, besides this, besides being carbon, it's diamagnetic. That is, it's repelled by magnetic fields. And again, and with the heart operation, there's a lack of understanding about how magnets work, which is a bit of a problem if you are a teacher and you know how it works. And you then explain it, and then people go, my dad says it differently. Look at this textbook. Look at so-and-so. They've said it worked this way. And, of course, they're all wrong. So magnets work on the magnetic force is the magnetic field gradient, the rate of change of magnetic field. It might be very obvious if you hold two magnets together, that's what's going on, but yeah, what more can I say? So I've got this little shim of this pyrolytic material. It cost me $23 from China on this route, and I have it floating on top, because this is one of the great things, is that it's floating. So it's not magnetic, it's isotropic carbon, it's graphite. And you go in there, the person's about to put it in, and you know, the surgeon says, oh, you've gone for a metal valve. And you go, yeah, I am. Just, you know how to open me up, you know the me bit of it, you don't necessarily know the physics part of it. So this little isotropic valve will float on top of a magnet. I do have a series of magnets. It's my little carbon, and it was just, you know, like the rest of the world getting things wrong, it's always so nice to actually have a little bit of an equation, a little experiment that you can sort of crawl back into and just observe it's right. It's not, so the experiment says it's okay, you can continue, but it is interesting there. So the overall theme is that it's absolutely fantastic. And I breathe very, very well, and I sort of can measure heart rate, and actually you they rehab you a bit, and you pick out the eyes of what you want to rehab, and that sort of instructs going ahead. Now, the only fly in the ointment, obviously, through all this, is the valve is, when it's closing, is no longer giving laminar flow. It's sort of like mechanically it collapses. And because of that, it forms little clots, and the metal or carbon, isotropic carbon one, also does this. And so you have to take this anti-clotting agents, which means that you have to bleed an INR factor, international, I don't know, bleed factor. I have to bleed 2.5 to 3.5 times more than a normal person. So that's the end of my, and if I ever want to go back to battle, I'll just bleed everywhere. And I did cut myself once, and it definitely took a day to stop bleeding, which normally would take a minute, a bit of an eye opener there. So you have to keep away. So you have to, when you're building things, you have to say, "Oh, won't use any knife. Will not do that. I'll avoid wear gloves like this." You get used to it, and you have to actually take this thing called a rat poison. The rat poison you have dissolves up. Fantastic. Absolutely fantastic. No more fencing for me. But this effect on the blood with a poor valve has led to all these little mini strokes and stuff like that, which requires been a huge effort, which has required podcasts, which gives you that entire closing theme. So, but it's hard to say in terms of, like, there's still memory problems, but sort of to compensate, I'm sort of building other strong things, obviously, like podcasting and the programming to get across. So that's the overall story. And so I'm now walking around with a little rocket part in my heart, and I have lived the process of Frankenstein. They have actually used a couple of wires sort of Frankenstein rather than this huge apparatus. They've got a tiny little watch battery, and it's fried the bejesus out of my heart when it goes. But so in a sense, I am a bit of a mechanical hybrid Frankenstein, and hopefully I'm still a person inside it all. Thanks for listening.
Another podcast, another story comes to a close. It's been a pleasure sharing this moment in time with you. May you discover truly amazing things, understand them, and tell others. Thanks for listening.